The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Wiggins. Broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Wiggins.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to the Tuesday evening Space Show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. We have a full Space Show program tonight with a great guest, actually the guest who started the Space Show. So I'll get to that in just a minute. All of the newsletters are up and current, so you can see the upcoming schedule. We still have a little bit of an issue on getting the Sunday guest to confirm, so that is still up in the air, but please check back on the upcoming show menu later in the week, and that will be filled in. I'm quite confident of that. And if you want to give us a call on today's program, and we certainly hope you do, it is toll free 1-866-687-7223. And calls are really great, much better than emails, but if you do want to email us, it is also Dr. Space, DRSPACE, at thespaceshow.com. And Dr. Grinspoon is doing a Mars update and a Venus mission update on Hotel Mars tomorrow. And our own Fremont John Jossi, he is doing an ISDC update as he was at the recent ISDC meeting. And we're going to find out what was talked about and what was good and what was inspiring, and that'll be an important show for this coming Friday, 9:30 a.m. California time. But for today, we do have a full-length Space Show program, and Dr. Patrick Collins is back with us. And Dr. Collins was the very first Space Show guest ever talking about space. And my doctoral dissertation is largely responsible for his help in guiding me on space tourism, and meeting up with him in some really great years at space conferences. I mean, I have to say those years were much better at conferences than later years, but I don't know, maybe it's just the nostalgia kicking in. But Patrick was an amazing assist to me, and we have been friends for, several decades now. And he is still a great guest on the Space Show when he comes on every once in a while. He has retired from teaching economics at Azabu University in Japan. He taught economics for 19 years there. He did his economics training at the London School. He is from the UK. Earlier, he was a guest researcher at the Research Center for Advanced Science and Technology of Tokyo University, RCAST, the National Space Development Agency, NASDA, the National Aerospace Laboratory, and the Institute for Space and Astronautical Sciences in Japan. And he was also a senior lecturer at the Imperial College of Science, Technology, and Medicine in London, and that's where he wrote his doctoral thesis on the economics of solar power satellites. And you all can guess what year that was, and he already had it nailed on solar power satellites. He is also VP of Space Renaissance International, and his research for the past 40 years has been on how to stimulate the growth of commercial space activities, the two most important opportunities being tourism and solar space satellites. And listen to this one, snow melting satellites, which we will certainly get to. Before I ask Patrick to join us, remember that the newsletter is posted. Everything we do is archived. We do have a store. If you're interested in Space Show logo wear, you click on the pictures of Pepper, the Siberian Husky, listening to the Space Show. And then please remember to go to the upper left menu, and Listen Now tells you, or Listen Live tells you how to listen to the live broadcast as well as the podcast and the compressed MP3s that make up our archives. And then also, please remember, we are listener-supported live broadcast internet talk radio, meaning you, the listeners, the people of you like you listening to this show, do support us, and we would not be doing this program without your great support. And it is really very, very important to us. I cannot stress that enough. As a 501c3 nonprofit with One Giant Leap Foundation, you are entitled to an IRS tax deduction if you pay federal taxes. Probably the same for state taxes, but do check with your state to see if they grant a tax deduction for another state's 501c3. Some do, some don't. And I don't know the rules for all 50 states, but I do know the rules for the federal government. And so if you are a federal taxpayer in the United States, your donation is tax deductible to One Giant Leap Foundation, the Space Show. And we also have sponsors, and the sponsors get those billboard ads going across our website. They get a message, which I will read a little later in the show, a promo message from each sponsor. And many of you might not want to sponsor us, but might want to get a message or an idea or some kind of a new theory or something out to a larger audience than, say, your blog or whatever means you might have to get out to a larger audience. So you can use those banner ads to promote whatever it is you want to promote. And your PR message can also promote whatever it is you want to promote. The messages and all of this stays on the archive program. So long, long after many, many years, people will still hear your promotions. So if you're interested, you email me at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. I've already introduced Dr. Patrick Collins, and he is in Japan, and it is a great honor and pleasure to have the guy back who started it all with his space tourism help with me on my doctoral dissertation and was our first ever Space Show guest. Patrick, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Hi, David. Very good to speak to you again. And really, congratulations on the length you've been running this show, because it's a historic archive, isn't it? I mean, you started, before the Internet, I think, didn't you?
Yeah, when I did it, when I started it, it was with a Phoenix radio station. So when you were on that very first time, we called you and piped you through a Phoenix radio station that did the live broadcast, and then I got the recording of that program on a cassette tape. And we didn't really have Internet archives until we switched about a year and a half or so later to a Seattle radio station. But we did the same thing there. We had to get cassette tapes back in the mail. And and then when I broke free of AM radio, it was to go Internet only. Podcasts had been around just a little while, and Tom Olson, who many of the leaders know, was telling me about podcasting since before it ever got started, probably. And Tom helped me get started, and we were an early adopter of podcasting, and but we still kept with our live broadcast on the Internet, and then we just recorded our shows and turned them into podcasts. And we're still very unique, Patrick, in that we do a live broadcast. So I don't know how much that is appreciated by listeners or not, because most podcasts are pre-recorded, and they don't have listener participation in the program.
Right.
Sometimes the guest is in the studio. Sometimes it's a telephone. The audio is usually better because they're not putting phone lines into the mix like we're doing, and that's a big, complicated process. But we're live, and callers can talk to you, and you're in Japan, and a caller could be in Germany if they want to call us, or they could be in we sometimes have a guy call us from Caracas, Venezuela. So, and the emails are all real time. So when we get an email, the guy or gal is actually sending it to us, and you're dealing with it, or you or the guest is dealing with it real time. And that's because we're committed to doing live broadcast shows, and they're much more complex and much more expensive, a lot more fun, if you ask me.
That's right. Interactive is much more attractive for listeners, isn't it?
Uh-huh. And the guests really seem to like the emails and the calls. you know, from the listeners. They don't know where they're coming from because we don't screen them. So if someone calls to talk to you, they may not even ask you a question about what we're talking about. And anyway, we're glad to have you back. And we're in our 21st year. But, Patrick, it was maybe 5 years of working on my dissertation, and you're doing incredible marketing surveys on space tourism. You really kicked it off, in my opinion, because you did high-quality marketing, economic, financial survey for commercial profitability, showing the potential of space tourism in the mid-1990s. You're the only one who had really high-quality work. And you got a lot of people excited. And finally, what is it, let's say around 1995, 1996, finally 2021, there are commercial space tourism flights. That's like 26 years, Patrick.
Right. But as you say, last year was great. It was a real beginning of a breakthrough, I think, to become an accepted idea. And, you know, there's always, you know, lots of different opinions. But in general, my impression is that the media accept it. You know, this is happening. This is going to happen. It's going to grow. And as you remember, I've always, the main reason I've always supported space tourism is because I don't see why it wouldn't grow like air travel. And, you know, apart from all these lockdowns, air travel is it employs about 100 million people around the world through all the, you know, tourism it enables. And so space travel would do the same. And, you know, it's just what we need is about 100 million new jobs, which involve fantastic high technology of all sorts, just like air travel does. So it's going to be really terrific for the economy, apart from anything else.
And all economies, because all countries participate in air travel. So, you know,
that's right.
It's open to everyone.
Well, I mean, it seems to me we still don't have any complete, you know, a company or something with a commitment to a low-cost passenger-carrying orbital vehicle. And we're obviously all hoping the Starship's going to work well and so on. But it seems to me it's basically a cargo carrier. You know, it's got can carry a very heavy payload, but it doesn't have a huge wide deck for passengers. So it'll be obviously great if it works well. But a dedicated passenger carrier will enable the whole thing to expand. And there's several companies now, aren't there, working on hotels, not only Bigelow, but Axiom and so on. And once we've got hotels in orbit, I've always said there's going to be space sports centers around the equator. Because equatorial orbit is very convenient if you don't want to have a look at the view, because the view is always just the equator. But you can get up and down in an hour and a half, because the hotels go over the space centers go over the same launch site every hour and a half. So the equatorial countries are going to be able to join in as well. So as you say, it'll be completely international from quite early stage, I think.
So do you think we're on track to see that kind of development take place in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, I've got my fingers crossed. I mean, as I said, we're obviously hoping that Starship is going to work well. And that Virgin, you know, they seem to have some sort of problem with their suborbital vehicle.
Right.
I hope, you know, and there's enough sort of enthusiasm already that other companies are going to start making serious investments. Because, as I say, if a company, you know, develops a low-cost passenger orbital vehicle, you know, then that'll, you know, the dike breaks and it'll just grow and grow and grow rapidly. So there's still, I think, a few years of touch and go, but obviously it's much better situation now than it has been, as you say, for the last 25 years.
We're seeing regular flights with Blue Origin. They had another one yesterday, and it didn't even get very much press, which tells us it's kind of routine. And
that's what I noticed,
But he had another one, I think, the seventh or the eighth flight, something like that, for Blue Origin. And but it's still not truly commercial because there's some favoritism going on seats and special rides and special, you know, favors going on who gets
the
ride.
In the early stages.
In the early stages, Yeah.
These days, is there any great new thing? You know, the rich and the powerful get the breaks, as they say. But business, the real big businesses are ones which then drive the cost down and expand the market. And so air travel was up to what? Up to 4 billion people a year, nearly 10 million a day in 2019. It'll presumably get back to that and go on growing bigger and bigger. 10 million a day, you know, that's a good number of people compared.
Go ahead.
Just 10 million a day. You know, when you talk about space tourism, maybe a million a year. Well, even space agencies are beginning to, get familiar with the idea. But for a long time, they would just say, you're mad. You know, talking about a million people going to space a year is crazy. But then you say, no, air travel is 10 million a day. You know, it's just orders of magnitude. They need to change their way of thinking. And that's beginning. And, you know, viewpoint is, well, yeah, like space tourism, it is possible after all, and actually it's popular.
When the tourism was going in 2020 and we started seeing resistance against billionaires in space and tourism and, there were widespread articles being written on that were, labeled naysayer articles. Usually didn't really understand anything about the economics or the physics or the engineering of space tourism. I was a little bit surprised to see such a uniform blowback against it and such contempt on billionaires and how they use their money. Most of the complaints were about these people need to be super taxed because they have to pay for all of what we need, and why not make them do for it? And then they shouldn't be able to use their money for some vanity thing like going into space. I tried to get a lot of these people on the show, some authors who wrote articles in the Atlantic, into the Atlantic. I contacted them through email, never got replies. They never seem to want to come on a live broadcast show, and they want to usually speak to a friendly audience, I guess. But were you surprised by all of this? And what was the mood like in Japan? Was it more supportive, or was it very critical of the early days of space tourism and the billionaires?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, as you say, of course, there's been bashing. Just to make a point, when I was working in London, there was a BBC program, which I've forgotten exactly what it was, but it used to bash people who were really stupid. And one of them, they bashed me, saying, because I was writing about space tourism. So I made a complaint, and I actually got a letter of apology after a struggle from the BBC for admitting that it was what they were saying about me was ridiculous, was totally untrue, and so on. But the mainstream media has been pretty negative quite a lot of the time, hasn't it? But over here, now in Japan, the difference in Japan is, you remember, the first Japanese who went to space was a journalist.
Right.
And so that kind of changed the image from being a government thing. It wasn't paid for by government. It was paid for by some companies for the, I've forgotten, it was the 40th anniversary of a TV station or something like that. And so they sent him up. And he was a nice guy, entertaining journalist. And so that really helped create a kind of an image of space travel, I think, from the start, as opposed to being government-funded and mostly military and that sort of thing. And then, recently there's been quite a good thing with this guy, Mr. Maezawa, who created this internet fashion business called Zozo Town, which is very popular. Oh, is very popular with young people. And then he sold it a couple of years ago for well over $1 billion. So it was very successful. He's only he's in his early 40s, and has made this deal with Elon Musk to fly with some friends around the moon.
Right, to orbit the moon. Uh huh.
Able to fly next year. I doubt if they'll fly next year, but anyway, they may do. And so when a very popular sort of fashion figure among young people does something like that, that's universally popular, it's
right.
A success. And he flew up to he flew on the Russian rocket, didn't he?
I think he did, yeah. He flew on the Soyuz.
Up to the space station already. Uh-huh. And he took one of his cohorts from the company with him, just, to be with a friend, which I thought is good. What it means, he's got $1 billion in his pocket, and he's using it, to do interesting things, and I think people like that. And if they get the flight to around the moon, that would be terrific publicity for the whole idea.
So
over here in Japan, there's several sort of private groups, associations pushing for space tourism. And this one, which I'm the chairman of, which was set up by some travel company guys. It was already 10, 15 years ago. Unfortunately, the founder died, Mr. Wakamatsu, but they wanted to push the idea because they said, the government's not. And they had customers who would say, can we get to space? And they looked into it, but they couldn't do it. And so we have, a meeting every couple of months in Tokyo. And it's still quite a small organization, but some very interesting people, from different businesses and advertising and so on. And it's all been a bit slow because of the clampdown on travel and tourism for the last 2 years. But I think it'll pick up again now as, people are relaxing again.
Yeah.
So there are, several groups, including rocket engineers and so on, planning small passenger vehicles and stuff. There's no sort of definite push yet. We'll have to see. But as an example of how it's sort of spreading, Toyota, you may know, is Japan is part of the Artemis project, the NASA-led project to do stuff on the moon. And so Toyota, a couple of years ago, announced they're developing a lunar rover, as they call it. You can easily find it on the web. And it's like a big truck, really. But it nominally carries two people cruising around the lunar surface for 6 weeks. So it's got airlocks for spacesuits and solar panels and water recycling and all that sort of thing. And it was just quite interesting when it was first announced, where the deputy head of Toyota, Toyota's a giant company, 100 times bigger than JAXA, the Japanese space agency, and they're doing it with JAXA. But he gave a few speeches here and there, and he said the Toyota engineers adore this project. And to me, that says almost everything, It's just space travel has a thing which just an awful lot of people, given the chance, given it was safe and cheap, would do. And engineers particularly, it's a sort of, tackling new problems is their lifeblood. And when it's as interesting as designing a rover for the moon, you can just see why they'd all be volunteering. I bet they all do overtime for free, and stuff, just to be part of it.
So there wasn't much bashing of the tourism and the tourists and the billionaires in Japan, not like there was in the West. And in the Europe, there was
That's
a lot
right,
of bashing,
yes.
too.
I'm not sure I've seen any bashing as such. It would be a bit different, you see, if the government was doing it, I suppose.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the things that quite often people who are bashing is tourism, they kind of mix up, don't they? They mix up. They think if it's in space, it must be taxpayers paying. And that's why it's totally different when companies and private individuals pay for something, even though they're riding, obviously, on the technology developed by space agencies over decades. I mean, it's a very sort of potentially promising situation, isn't it, where there is all this technology, space technology, and this amazing amount of know-how, propulsion and artificial environments and so on, so that all that technology can be used by engineers and companies and stuff, so it potentially allows very rapid progress once serious investments start getting made. And Toyota, of course, once Toyota does something, Honda does as well. So Honda's working on lunar stuff, particularly using water, splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen and then recombining them to get electricity. And as you know, it's a famous idea that
right.
That's a sort of thing. But they're actually doing that, and again, with NASA. But with JAXA, but I don't think they get money from the government. I think that both them and Toyota are doing it on their own. In fact, I'm sure Honda isn't, because it's a famous thing about Honda. Nowhere in the world do they take money from governments, different from other big car companies.
I did not know that. So they don't take money from any government?
Yeah.
Well, that has endeared Honda to me over Toyota then. I like that model.
Right. I think it came from Soichiro, the founder of Honda, who is a famously entertaining speaker and innovative guy, and would sort of do crazy things. And the engineers absolutely adored him, and so I think it was his personality. He would never take money from government, just because it would constrain him. As soon as you take some money from government, they don't have to be bad or anything. It's just totally constraining, because they have to set their rules and so on. Otherwise, you know, governments have to be accountable for everything. So that, as you say, it's definitely a feather in Honda's cap, I think.
What do you make of this new interest in, and you've been talking about it for the last 5 or 10 minutes, about getting to the moon? And it looks like it's mostly a private sector operation, even if they're working through Artemis, which is government, because the private companies around the world are the ones working to make the lunar hardware.
Yeah, well, overall, I think it's very promising. I mean, as you know, the moon isn't that far away, and we went there 50 years ago, so it's all totally possible, and it's, as always, it's the key is to make the cost of getting to the lunar surface and back lower, and as the lower it gets, the easier it is to do things there. But I think that the Artemis project and the other ones in other countries, because you know, the Artemis is obviously Europe, America, and Japan, but Russia and China are very, you know, working on lunar plans.
Right.
China's very vigorous there, and so is India. And so that between them, they're obviously going to push forward a lot of technologies useful for working on the moon. And, one of the things that's kind of interesting is how the new technology which is pushing forward now, one of them is 3D printing, you know, what they call additive manufacturing.
Right.
Which... a few years ago, it was just making little plastic toys, and it seemed trivial. But it's already zooming ahead now, isn't it? I mean, they make food, and they make use metal now. There's rocket engines and stuff. And they're talking about being able to 3D printed houses around the world. They're starting. And then they're talking about being able to do that on the moon. There's quite a lot of groups, I think, who are looking at that, lunar architects and things. And once you can 3D print houses on the moon or buildings on the moon, that really makes it really a kind of interesting. I mean, that's a piece of infrastructure that's absolutely essential for lunar tourism or whatever. And if that's much nearer than we might think, because you may remember, 30, 40 years ago, people talked about lunar concrete and, where would you get the water, and maybe you could use sulfur instead of water, and basically rather complicated things. But if you can just directly print it out of lunar rock, which apparently, there's an industry, cast basalt industry, where they companies on the Earth, melt rock, and they make pipes and things with very high resistance to wear and tear. But they also make fibers, cast basalt fibers, apparently, which are very, very strong and tough. And so this sort of vision, isn't there, that, manufacturing on the moon will be quite different from manufacturing on the Earth, because you're working with a totally different range of resources and constraints. And certainly this particular topic of additive manufacturing looks very, very promising.
You have a caller on hold. Let's see who's calling you. Good evening, caller. Who are you and where are you, please? Thank you for calling.
Hi, David. Charles from Boston.
Oh, okay, Charles, you need to speak up because you're
no,
not
hello.
Very clear.
Is this any better?
No, speak really loud into the phone. Cause
okay, here you go.
That's better.
Charles Lurio from Boston.
That's better.
And I don't know if Patrick remembers me, but we met many years ago at a couple of space conferences, and I was wondering what had happened to him, and so when I saw him on David's schedule, on your schedule, I had to tune in here, and I guess you're still fighting the good fight, Patrick.
Thanks. I didn't catch your surname, I'm afraid.
Lurio, L-U-R-I-O.
Charles Lurio. Ah, yes, indeed, of course. I get your newsletter through your
great
generosity.
I'm never sure that sometimes I'm not sure that people are getting it, actually. But
right. No, great. I love it. And thanks for calling in. Yes. No, I haven't been to the States for years. Not 10, 15 years or something. And at the moment, the travel is still so confused, so that I'm not going to be there any time in the future. But great to hear from you. And you too must feel, that after decades of pushing, things are just beginning to move in the right direction.
Yes. It's sort of hard. Sometimes it's harder to deal with success than failure, but in a funny way. But it's good to see it happening. I don't know if you caught my a little essay that I wrote a few issues back called "Hooray for something like Hooray for Billionaires," because you know, without those folks, we would still be stuck in the NASA model, in the old space government model. You know, so.
That's right. I think you're right. And that's another sort of three cheers for the Internet, because the Internet, for you know, all its weirdness, has enabled a number of people to get incredibly rich while still young, it seems to me. You know, there are lots of great businessmen who get very rich, but, you know, by the time they're 60, when they're no longer, you know, they're no longer looking for adventure. But if people like this Mr. Maezawa in Japan, he gets to be a billionaire at 40. No, he's still got buzz and to go to the moon. So that's right. And billionaires, as you say, they, you know, they love to complain and so on, but they do things. And just starting to make reusable rockets has been a terrific start. I mean, by
and I don't know if you saw this recent article about it really is something that I guess a lot of people sort of had known by osmosis over the years, but there was a study done at Oxford that said, well, you know, the problem with those government things is they set this endpoint goal, they have a grand plan, and then they try to go directly to it. Whereas folks like SpaceX, you know, build up from evolutionary fashion and to eventually having larger and greater capabilities. And that's certainly what they've done, and it's certainly been a lot more successful than, you know, all the plans that have failed from the government or ended up so costly as to be impractical. And now you have, I mean, I like the fact that we have a moon program, but you've got an ox in tandem with a horse with the space launch system there. You know, it's really kind of a funny situation, but I'll take the horse part. It's running because it's pushing the situation, pushing the capabilities.
Charles, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Did you read the recent? I mean, we're switching a little bit from the moon to Mars out of order here, but did you read the recent New York Times op-ed with Paul Krugman on Musk and going to Mars?
No, I tend to avoid such.
I wanted to ask you about it because he. He has a new op-ed about how sort of crazy Musk is, and Patrick and I were talking about it before the show tonight. And I know you're back in that part of the territory, so I wondered if you had seen it yet.
Was this in the Sunday Times or was it in another?
I don't have that. It was sent to me by someone else because I don't see the Times on a regular basis. He basically. You know, says that it takes, you know, millions and millions of people to start a new civilization, and Musk is crazy, and on and on and on, you know, and is not going to accomplish anything, and it's his fantasy, and plus he had some derogatory things to say up in the front of it, and then he seemed to think that he was going factual, but he really doesn't know a lot on the subject from what I could tell.
Yeah, well, that's you see that all the time these days, particularly when you can throw mud at a guy just for having a lot of money, although I wish I could have people throwing money at me for throwing mud at me for that reason. Unfortunately, I'm not that privileged.
No. Anything else, Charles?
Well, I just wanted to make sure that Patrick and I could perhaps exchange notes. Patrick, so apparently my stuff has been getting to you. So that's
yes, indeed.
Valid. Apparently,
I'll email you.
Okay.
Or I'll give you his address off air, Charles. I'll send it to you too.
Oh, well, you have it.
That's fine. Whatever is most satisfactory to folks.
Okay.
So,
all right, great to see you, Charles.
Anything else, Charles, or is that it?
That's about it for now, I think.
Okay. All right.
Well, I agree with Charles about the role of government space agencies. I mean, they can develop technology, and when they move in a certain direction, that sort of leaves technical capabilities that others can then use. And as you were saying about the Artemis project, the SLS, making new expendable rockets is pretty well, a bit late in the game, isn't it? I was talking to someone yesterday about what's called the sailing ship effect. Once steamships were invented, sailing ships were going to disappear for sure. But the last commercial sailing ships sailing grain from Australia to Europe were operating in 1939. So the effect of the competition of steamships is to drive the existing but going obsolete technology to the limits. And these sailing ships, the last ones, were steel, everything, the cabling and steel. They just drove, ever faster than the old wooden sailing ships and stuff. But they were still obsolete, And I think expendable rockets are in that situation now, aren't they? I mean, for big, heavy objects, they're still going to be useful for a while, But they can't possibly be, the major way of opening up the moon.
Absolutely. You're certainly right about that, too. So,
yeah.
I was just writing about something the other day, or actually right now, about the NASA that basically has given up on building its own spacesuits and is going to just share the technology with the companies that it is selected to get, certain fixed price rewards for fulfilling certain tasks along a path. And just because they have been trying to come up with something that at least fulfills some of the requirements satisfactorily, but it's never quite fit, so to speak. No pun intended. And they hope that the private sector will do better. And they are already putting in a lot of money privately. The Axiom space station people have already done a lot of work on their own suit. So,
and I think the other company is Collins, isn't it? No relation, I don't know.
Collins is the other one, yes. They're partnered with ILC Dover, which did the lunar surface suits for Apollo.
Right.
All right. Okay. There was an interesting article written decades ago by a guy, I think it was to do with the diving industry, and he was pointing out that diving harnesses go down to, I've forgotten now, a few hundred meters, like 20 atmospheres or something, are a very well-established technology, and a diving harnesses that will protect you and is flexible and so on. It costs like tens of thousands of dollars, and yet Apollo spacesuits, as you know, they cost like $100 million each and stuff. So that there's a potential
breakthrough. There is a company called Oceaneering, I think they call it, that is partnered with one of the two winners.
Is that right?
And I think that's the same company. David, maybe you remember this, that talked about doing lunar missions, like 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah,
their capabilities to that.
I took a commercial diving class from them in the Long Beach Harbor. I wanted to do hard hat diving and know what it was like. So I did a commercial class. They trained us in a Mark 7 helmet and the canvas suit, And we were in Long Beach Harbor, about 35 feet down, something like that. And they have pipes and valves all over the floor of the harbor to train these guys, and big, huge wrenches and stuff that you would be doing, just like you're, say, working on an oil rig or something. And the helmets have one-way valves, and they taught us the physics and the engineering of the helmets and the one-way valve. Without the one-way valve, if you had a problem, you could be sucked out and killed pretty quickly. So they designed one-way valves for these helmets, and they're pretty safe. And, you know, we were connected to tubing on the surface ship, the compressor, so we had air hoses, and we were tethered, and we wore leather boots, not leather boots, lead boots, and you know, and big heavy gloves, just like you see in the pictures. And, you know, we had to undo valves and connect valves, and we had the heavy lights because the Long Beach Harbor is pretty thick with grud and no visibility. But, yeah, we were well protected from the environment in those suits. I have to tell you now, I understand a spacesuit has to protect from a different kind of environment, but we were very, very well insulated and protected from the environment, and they didn't cost anywhere as close to what a spacesuit cost. And they're made by commercial companies.
Yeah, well, you need people who actually need to do something to move things
right.
along.
There's a customer there. There's
train people for the oil fields and
the states, because there are three functions. There's the people who make the aircraft, the people who operate the aircraft, and the people who overlook safety. And they have to be independent of each other. So long as you have those three independent functions, then the thing works. And the nuclear industry and the space industry don't really have that. That's why they had this big accident in Japan, because the safety engineers were basically, you know, friends of the guys building the station.
Right.
Also, you know, swapped into the operating companies. And that, as you say, Charles, about the they're doing things that people want them to do, and they're going to pay them to be successful. As long as there's somebody separate who won't pay you if you don't succeed, that focuses you on doing it cheaply, doesn't it?
Yes, it certainly does. Okay.
All right, Charles, thank you very much for your call.
Thanks for letting me.
Okay.
Go on and on.
Okay, bye-bye.
Listeners,
Charles has cleared the line. If you'd like to call us, we'd like to hear from you. It is 1-866-687-7223. What is a snow satellite?
Snow melting satellite.
Yeah, a snow melting satellite. What is that?
Well, this is the thing. I first wrote a paper about it in 2010, and this is because everyone knows about the environment and so on.
Right.
But the government's environment policies are very unbalanced, in my opinion.
Oh, really?
Climate changing, and we need to take precautions to prevent it changing in a bad way and so on. But they only focus on the possibility that it's going to get hotter. And they completely ignore the possibility that it's going to get colder. And the environment has been changing, as you know, for billions of years. And there are times when it gets hotter and times when it gets colder. And there's a very serious professional group of climate researchers who say we're heading into a little ice age. Now, on the top of that, we're due for another real ice age sometime, not very far from now, because, as you know, the globe cools down significantly for the ice age. There's been a pattern for some millions of years where there's 10,000 years of warmth and then 100,000 years of cold. And the 100,000 years of cold, everything from in the northern hemisphere, from Moscow west to Seattle, gets completely covered in a kilometer of ice. So if we get another ice age, well then, unless we're well prepared, we'll just all be killed. But if we take precautions, we could move south or take some other precautions. But a little ice age lasts for just a few decades, typically, and is just a few degrees cooler than normal, what we consider normal today. But even, as you probably know, even just a few degrees cooling in the climate can be very, very damaging to agriculture. You know, a single bad frost, you know, late in the spring can cause terrible damage to agricultural crops. And so, and the other thing is, if you make a comparison between the threats of global warming and the threats of global cooling, you know, there's pros and cons on both sides and the evidence on both sides. But the worst case,
the worst case of cooling is far, far, far worse than the worst case of heating. You talk to the climate people today, they say, well, the worst case is that in about 30 years, the world will be a few degrees warmer, okay, and that will be damaging for this, that, and the other. But the worst case for an ice age is, like, within a year, about half... The population of the northern upper half of the northern hemisphere will disappear, because researchers have found that some of the ice ages, and maybe all, started very suddenly. And when they say very suddenly, their description is this: meters of snow every day for months on end. Well, now here in Japan, they get very heavy snow up in the north and on the west coast sometimes, and they typically get, you know, a meter in a day. And a meter of snow, you know, stops everything, you know, and it causes a lot of trouble and so on. But they're used to it. All the trucks get out and clear the roads, take the snow off the roofs, and the buildings that have collapsed, collect them and so on. So, you know, a week or two, it's all back to normal. But if they had a meter of snow one day, and the next day they had a meter of snow, and the following day they had a meter of snow, and every day they had another meter of snow, within 2 weeks, everybody would be dead. I mean, literally, there's no way people could clear the roads or get out of their houses or anything. So a significant flip to a colder climatic situation could be absolutely devastating. So then if you just do an absolutely normal risk-benefit type analysis, you say, well, okay, you can make the risk as small as you like, but if the potential cost is so devastating, you know, you shouldn't ignore it. And yet governments do absolutely no preparation whatever. For several years, as a researcher, I was applying for grants to just look into crops that are good under cold conditions, because they're all doing research and developing crops that are good under hot conditions. But they, in my opinion, they should be doing the same on the other side as well, on, you know, what would be good for colder conditions, if they were seriously professional and scientific about climate policy. And on top of that, if you say, okay, we've got this terrible threat to civilization of a real ice age sometime, which could happen any time. It may not happen for 1,000 years, but it could happen this year. What is there any way we could possibly hold it back? And the only possible way that I've come across, and I'm keen for ideas from other people, is to use solar power satellites, use the microwave beams, to melt snow. And if you want to melt the snow for about 1 million square kilometers on the ground, which is the least you'd want to do, if you're trying to protect the northern half of the northern hemisphere, you need about 1 million square kilometers of solar power satellites, which, you know, is a huge deal. But it's, to me, it was just sort of fascinating that the project which I spent a lot of time on since my PhD in solar power satellites may be the only way we could possibly hold back an ice age. And so I spent a bit more time on that and, you know, trying to get people to do some more work on melting snow with microwaves. And a colleague here did a little bit. He had a research student look into it. And the first conclusion he came to is snow is very complex. Because when you've got, you know, snow that's built up over a few months, it's got all sorts of layers in of different degrees of melt and ice and stuff. And so he found there's actually the Japanese Snow Society. And so he's going to do some collaboration with them to work out some, you know, kind of models of average conditions and stuff like that. But that's what a snow melting satellite is. And as I veer towards thinking cooling is a more dangerous problem than warming, I think there should be some serious work done on using solar power satellite technology for melting snow over large areas. I think it's perfectly straightforward, basically, and actually I say it's much lower cost than using solar power satellites for energy supply, because the conditions you need are more relaxed. You don't have to have very accurate pointing, just aiming the beam at your receiving antenna. It's drifting about over the ground. You could probably use a drone to pull the beam along where you want to go. And it wouldn't really matter if the wavelength varies a bit, or it cuts off for a few minutes or even a few hours. You're just interested in the cumulative energy dumped into the ground to prevent it freezing or to melt the snow or whatever. And you don't need to build a rectenna, which, of course, is a gigantic, as you know, a gigantic system of at least square kilometers, probably tens of square kilometers of wire mesh. So the cost is much less. So I've actually written a paper saying SMS before SBS. It aimed to develop SMS is a good step on the way towards solar power satellites.
How safe is it that when people hear you're going to be beaming microwave directly down to the Earth? What are they going to say to that one?
Well, for solar power satellites, you do it just at a dedicated receiving antenna.
Right.
And there are places you can do it where people aren't going to complain. And one of them, which I was involved in the European Space Agency in the 80s, is you build artificial islands in the North Sea. You could build, and in the Mediterranean, you can build what they call polders, where you build a big sea wall, a circular sea wall, and pump out the water. And then you use the land inside that. So you're nowhere near anybody.
Well, they can. I was going to say they can learn from China how to build artificial islands. They'd be maybe willing to teach them.
And some countries have lots of uninhabited islands. I worked with a guy from Indonesia, a researcher there, and he said, "Well, I've forgotten, I've like 20,000 uninhabited islands in Indonesia. So you might build, a hydrogen plant there, where you'd lose the power continuously to generate hydrogen out of seawater or something like that." So for solar power satellites, the energy supply, you don't have to, do it over people's homes or anything. But if you're going to use it for melting snow, now the only condition you do it would be where there's a serious threat, you see. And so obviously any danger would be based on the intensity in the beam. And the usual intensity talked about for solar power satellites is a couple of hundred watts per square meter. Right. So in terms of heat, that's about a quarter of intense sunlight. Hot sunlight is about a kilowatt per square meter, okay? So you can certainly do it at a level which wouldn't be dangerous. And if it was going to become a serious issue, like, if there was evidence that an ice age was approaching and you were going to start to use this beam from space, sort of sweep along, a row of cities along the northern edge of North America or Europe, you could easily protect people from microwaves by putting, it's called a Faraday cage, which is basically like chicken wire. So you just put chicken wire into all the walls and ceilings and roofs of the buildings and so on. And anyone indoors would be completely unaffected. So then you could actually pump it up to quite high power if you wanted to, if it was necessary, if there's a lot of snow, say. It's a kind of interesting problem where it relates to weather modification, because there's been a big thing about weather modification. There's a lot of stories about the extent to which it's being done, but the main problem as a business situation is that if you modify the weather somewhere else is going to get probably worse weather, and they're going to sue you. So it's legally very, very difficult situation. So I don't think it'll probably become a commercial service, but in the situation where you're either going to be buried in snow or we're going to start melting the snow with microwaves. I think, I guess, that can be solved, at least in some places.
Patrick, you have a caller on hold. Do you want to take it?
Yeah, sure.
Sure. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program tonight. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Marshall.
Hi, Marshall.
Here in Oklahoma. And I like this idea of using microwaves to heat up and melt down snow and so on. Do you think you can make it small enough to where a quarter of a square mile could be heated up to stop crop damage? I could see that as a real business.
Great question. As it happens, there was a meeting here in Japan in 2014 where an elderly Chinese researcher called Dr. Ge Changchun made this point. He said, in northeast China, we get these heavy snowfalls, he said, and it would be really great if you could use some of these satellites to melt the snow for us. And that was what I was been thinking up till then, just about ice ages, the gigantic scale. And that was what made me see, this is potentially a service that could be paid for today. The question, as you say, how small a scale can it be done? Well, the problem about satellites is that if you're in lower orbit, the satellite moves rather fast across the sky. So you couldn't, you could make a small enough beam from a low orbit satellite, but it would only deliver for a few minutes. That's the problem. And then the next time it would come over your same patch would be like days later, because the orbits shift as the Earth rotates, you see. So the usual thing is to talk about geostationary orbit. Well, where the satellite is in, takes 24 hours to go around the Earth, and so it's always above the same point. The problem with that is that's just because of physics. It's what, 22,000 miles above the Earth.
Right.
And so to get a beam down to the ground, it's very difficult to make a very narrow beam. If you use very high frequency, like laser even, it's blocked by much of the atmosphere. So that small scale is quite difficult. But actually, it's quite interesting because I and some colleagues were making a proposal to study this quite recently because I think it was last year, or maybe it was this year, I think it was last year, in the spring, in a large area of France, they had a very late frost. As you're talking about, you know, agriculture, and they lost a third of the wine crop just overnight. And so if you could have, you know, if you could call a microwave beam down to just keep the temperature above, you know, whatever it needs to be, that would be worth billions. They said that just that cost them billions of dollars.
I just thought about the orange crop in Florida.
Yeah.
Every 10 years they get a frost that, you know, destroys half the orange trees.
That's right. But what I think is, I don't think it's feasible to make a one that's as pinpoint as, you know, like a few hundred meters or like just a half a mile or something. But I think it would be possible to do it where it's not at a level that's dangerous. It would just, you know, raise the temperature of in the simplest terms, the microbeam, as it hits the ground, it's absorbed, okay? Most things just absorb microwaves and just warm up a little bit. So if you've got an area which is, you know, going -2 or -3 and you want to warm it up, even the other areas nearby, which were normal, they wouldn't suffer from having the temperature rise a couple of degrees. So I think you could still have a beam, you know, like a few miles across maybe, just sweep across at the, whatever the right speed, you know, to protect the areas. And I would have thought that's a economically and technically realistic possibility.
Well, you brought up saving a grape crop. I was thinking a thought of oranges, and, you know, there's all sorts of fruits and vegetables that are extremely temperature sensitive. I could really see that being a real business. Hope you crack the problem and make an economical conclusion on it.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marshall. I appreciate this hearing from you. Good call. Thank you. Okay.
Okay. Bye bye.
Bye bye. Listeners, Marshall is gone. You're too able to give us a call. Great grammar there. Our toll-free number, for those of you who would like to call and talk to Patrick, 1-866-687-7223. I want to real quickly mention our individual sponsors, okay? And they're Northrop Grumman, and they are the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwards, Celestis, and the National Space Society. And I'm going to take a liberty here and not read their 60-second promo messages because I want to keep talking with Patrick. But I do want to shout out to our sponsors and tell them they're deeply appreciated. We would not be doing the program without their great support of the Space Show. They're deeply, deeply appreciated. Northrop Grumman, Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwards, Celestis, and the National Space Society. You can also be a sponsor, or you can be a billboard advertiser and be thanked profusely and also put out your message that you want people to hear. Just to get the information, email me, drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. Are we, in your opinion, advancing at a reasonable rate towards space solar power?
That's a good topic as well.
And kind of funnily enough, I think it's quite promising at the moment. I'm working with some people in Europe at the moment on that field because, as you probably know, a whole lot of European countries, I'm not sure if all of them have, but have said they're going to stop using coal, oil, gas, and uranium for energy production, which makes me laugh because they've no idea what they're going to do because their current plans of solar panels on the ground and windmills just quite incapable of producing the amount of energy that Europe needs and is going to need in the future. So the space industry are making a push, which they haven't done for some time now, to say, well, look, how about solar power satellites? You know, this is solar energy. It's completely silent, smoke-free, pollution-free on the ground once you set it up. But it needs a lot of investment up front. And there's been a bit of work in Britain where the government paid for a study, which seems quite promising, came to quite a promising conclusion. And the European Space Agency has a number of contracts out on different aspects to try to show that it's going to, you know, it would be a good direction to move in. The obstacle which remains and has been there all along is the gap between the electricity industry and the space industry. And the gap is that the space industry doesn't have, at least the space agencies, don't have the role. They aren't officially required to consider the energy supply. That's not in their brief. And the electricity industry just says, well, we don't know anything about space, you know. And they need to get the electricity industry interested in the possibility of, like, gigawatts of power coming from rectennas. And in my thesis, my doctoral thesis about it, I said, let's split the SPS, the concept, into the rectenna and the satellite as different things. The rectenna is a facility owned and operated by electricity companies. And they buy microwave power from satellite operating companies, who will probably also be different from the satellite constructors. And obviously the first solar power satellite system will be a satellite and a rectenna, and they'll just try to keep pumping the energy down as much as they can. But if it catches on and they start building a bunch of rectennas around the place and a bunch of satellites, then you get this huge benefit from satellites that they can switch the beam they send at very high speed from, you know, across thousands of kilometers. You know, they could be sending the beam to somewhere in eastern Russia and then switch it back to Western Europe or from Europe to America. And so this is, or from Northern Europe to Southern Europe, you see. So it could supply Northern Europe in the winter and Southern Europe in the summer. And this is a really unique additional capability of solar power satellites and the power they can supply. Because, as you know, one of the big problems with solar and wind is that, you know, on a windy day or a gusty day, you know, you suddenly get a lot of power, and then minutes later, you've got nothing.
You've got nothing,
solar, you know, a sunny day turns cloudy, and you lose 5 gigawatts in, like, 10 seconds. And so having, I mean, you probably know, that's one of the reasons why a lot of, still at the moment, solar energy and wind energy have a problem, because they need backup. You have to keep ordinary, in other words, coal, oil, gas, and nuclear power stations running in the background to take over in case the power suddenly drops, and to build up the power in seconds. It's a very expensive process. So that the thing that has to be done is for the energy policy makers to wake up, to face, you know, to get wise about this and to agree that some of their budget can be used to develop solar power satellites. Because the energy budgets and the energy industry is, well, it's 100 times bigger than the space industry. I mean, the space industry talks about billions, you know, maybe, I think NASA's, is it 30 billion or something?
Uh-huh.
But the energy industry is trillions. And so if they would just agree to, you know, to start work on solar power satellites, and that energy budgets can be used for that as well, then we could see quite rapid progress, I think.
Patrick, I kept, when I left California, I kept an app on my phone because it's pretty interesting. It's the California ISO, which is the organization that runs the grid for the whole electrical power part of California. And it breaks down the demand of all energy from all sources, the percentage of renewables, and then the amount of renewables that are actually feeding the demand. And renewables include solar, wind, geothermal, biomass, biogas, and small hydro. So the current demand is almost 33,000 million watts of energy. And renewables are doing 7.563%. And of that, renewables, and that's because it's daylight savings time, and it's still daylight out here as it's 8 o'clock at night. We still have daylight, and we still have heat. So solar is about 3.8%. Wind, and this varies from day to day and type of day, is 75%. Geothermal is 9%. Biomass is 4%. Biogas is 2.4%, and small hydro, whatever that means, is 4%. But as we continue to go into evening and it becomes dark, the current demand will probably rise a little bit, and the amount of renewables is going to keep going down until it's almost nothing. And so what's happening is the backup, as you just said, will start kicking in to continue to supply California with energy as long as there's enough backup to do it. Otherwise, there'll be brownouts or blackouts. So I watch this with renewables all the time, and I watch how they fade off in the late afternoon and the early evening. Now, if we were in the wintertime, there'd be zero renewables at 8 o'clock at night, and everything would have to be coming from whatever our fossil fuel is in California, which is being curtailed, as everyone knows. And now they're fighting to keep the one last nuclear plant open in California.
Right.
You know, and interestingly, Gavin Newsom, the governor, has come to his senses about it, and he's asked for the White House to help him persuade Pacific Gas and Electric to keep it open. So that's a weird combination of who's fighting for nuclear, and it's unknown whether PG&E will keep that nuclear plant going. But you can watch the renewables go down. And as I said, the only reason they're at 23% right now is because we have daylight savings time, and it's 8 o'clock, and it's still light outside. And, of course, I'm in the desert where it's still probably 95 or 98 degrees. But that's not the way it is across California. So that renewable, if I checked it in 30 minutes, it'd probably be down to maybe 18% or 17%. And they just can't produce the power. So I love your idea.
The funny thing about the solar panels, as you know, they face a fixed direction.
Right.
So, you know, they peak at usually typically midday. And then even when it's still light and the sun's shining, the power goes right down because they're facing the wrong direction. You know, the sun comes from the west and they're facing south.
Right.
And, you know, people say, oh, well, why don't they turn them around? The problem is you can design a system that rotates and faces the sun and things, but it's so much more expensive and uses more land that it doesn't pay.
Well,
so they only use even a small amount of the actual sunlight.
Las Vegas did that, and it's called Ivan's something, and it's 30 miles south of Las Vegas. And the solar collectors are the size of a minivan car or a minivan, and they track the sun. It costs several billion dollars to build, and the solar panels heat three towers of molten salt.
And, so the thermal, right.
So, and then they take the heat from the salt, and they transmit it into power, and that's providing electrical power for a big portion of Las Vegas at night. However, the plant is not economical, and it costs money, and it has a lot of problems. It's a prototype plant, so maybe those kind of bugs will someday be worked out of it. But it is clearly not economical to build it, although the company that built it said they're building two much bigger ones that will be economical. One's in China, so they claim, and they claim they're building one in Brazil. But they are on, the panels are really huge, and they do track the sun, but they take energy to track the sun.
Right. It's a solar thermal plant, isn't it? They're mirrors.
Right. They're mirrors, and they're heating up and turning salt into molten salt and collecting the energy from that and turning it into turbines, and then they generate electricity. But it doesn't make money.
Right, it's still not economic, but it's quite interesting. It has the advantage over solar panels, photovoltaic panels.
Absolutely.
The heat, you can store the heat. They build tanks, you know, with big thermal insulation around them. And once you've put this salt up to, what, a few hundred degrees or even maybe 1,000 degrees, it keeps that heat for hours. And so you can actually then use the energy to generate during the night. So it does have that advantage over photovoltaics. But as you say, I find it doubtful that they can become a significant, you know, like tens of gigawatts of that power as a power source. And the other thing is that mirrors depend on direct sunlight. Photovoltaic panels, even when it's cloudy, they generate, you know, not as much, obviously. But they don't need direct sunlight. But mirrors need direct sunlight in order to reflect. You know, a cloudy day, it gets nothing. So that it swings around about, isn't it? And, you know, hats off for everyone to try to work out all these different systems. But I think it's time to bridge this gap between the energy industry, the energy policymakers, and space, the space industry, and just face the fact that this is another potential. And there's a figure that in Europe, they're planning to spend 5 trillion euros, which is a bit more than $5 trillion, over the next, 20, 30 years, to get off coal, oil, gas, and uranium. And just 1% of that would be plenty to develop solar power satellites. So that 1% would be 50 billion. You would certainly be able to get a solar power satellite industry underway with that sort of investment. But that sort of investment is, you know, outside, the space industry doesn't have that sort of money, but the energy industry does. So I'm hoping, and a lot of people are hoping, that this extreme pressure the governments have put themselves in, the corner they put themselves in, you know, how can we supply enough energy without coal, oil, gas, or uranium?
Well, but it doesn't seem
to try. Yeah.
You know, it doesn't seem to catch on with policymakers. So there is individuals. I have a guy who comes on the show with a commercial space solar power company that he started, John Bucknell. And, you know, he's small potatoes, and he's trying to make it commercial. And there's a few other things like that. But they don't get into the policymakers. You know what I mean? They don't get as far as having the government finance a significant demo plant to test new technologies to then put out to the commercial industries. And that's
right.
What's missing is getting – you know, the government to get involved in the R&D. Now, the Naval Research Lab and organizations like that do research on it, but, you know, that big demo and where they can share the technology with commercial companies, it still isn't happening.
Right. Well, with some people, you know, who I work with there, there's talk of what we need next step could perhaps be a system, you know, maybe beaming energy between two mountaintops, okay, well away from anybody's causing trouble, for anybody. But it's got to be tens of kilowatts over a few kilometers, and it's got to operate for a few months so that electricity company people can come and see it and see the antenna. And they say, you know, yeah, even when it rains or it's dark or no noise, no nothing, but energy is coming out of this. If electricity companies would set up a Rectenna research center, there's a lot of interesting technology they need to do. And one of them is weatherization of the Rectenna. Because you probably know the Rectenna, the basic idea is rather simple. It's a whole sort of wire mesh with lots of little dipoles connected through diodes to generate, to collect the energy and make DC electricity, like for photovoltaic panels. But like any electricity supply system, it's got to have a lifetime of 40 years, you know. And so designing, and what happens when it gets struck by lightning, and how do you repair it and so on. And I suspect that these dipoles have to be covered in a plastic layer. So that then you've got to use plastics, which can put up with, you know, outdoor weather for 40 years, which I'm not sure if there are. I know that watering cans soon go brittle in the sunlight. So that there's a lot of... And then the across the face of the Rectenna, which is probably going to be tens of square kilometers, if not more, you'll have different arrays of diodes, because in the center of the beam, the power is bigger than at the edge of the beam. So you'll have a different set of diodes and different way of connecting together to generate the gigawatts. And so from my point of view, I think this is really interesting engineering. There's, you know, all pioneering stuff. And so once some electricity companies get together and say, hey, let's do this, it'll be great. I mean, it'll really, you know, move forward. But there's a hurdle to get over to persuade them to do that and get policymakers to start talking about it.
Do you have any suggestions for how to move that discussion forward to having action taken by governments to put together such an R&D center?
Yeah, it's a sort of cultural thing, I suppose, isn't it? In the sense that you've got these industries with their committees and their systems and so on, and they don't meet. And as I say, I think that the most important thing, well, this is when I came to Japan, the reason I stayed here originally was this project called SPS 2000, was to put a low-orbit satellite around the equator, which would deliver 10 megawatts. And each rectennet would pass over would just get the power for a few minutes. But an hour and a half later, the satellite would come over again. So it could be, you know, reasonably useful. And around the equator, of course, there's several hundred million people with no electricity still. So that was the project. And I had the job of visiting the countries around the equator to find sites for the rectennets, which was quite fun. But the thinking behind it was this guy, Professor Nagatomo, who unfortunately has died now, but he said it's got to be megawatts. You know, electricity companies deal with gigawatts, so that if you talk to them about kilowatts, well, you know, they just sort of say, well, you know, it's like a toy, you know. But once you've got megawatts, you know, they'll take interest, he said, and they'll go and visit all the rectennets and see how each one works. You know, there's going to be ones, we had one that was going to be in the Andes, and would get snow in the winter, and then there'd be ones over the sea, and then ones, there's going to be one over the jungle in Brazil. And so they'd each have a different set of, you know, of environmental stresses. And it would just be a real, real learning project for the electricity industry. And once they get interested, you know, it would really push forward. So the steps that are needed, which I think everyone agrees on, there needs to be a big, more serious, long-term demonstration on the ground. There then needs to be a low-orbit satellite of some sort, because still no one has sent power from space to the ground. If you make the first step has to be in geostationary, then you have to have a kilometer diameter antenna, and it has to cost billions. So it's a big jump, that. So I think you have to have a low-orbit satellite project of some sort. And so I'm still in favor of around the equator, because it seems it's more fun than, you know, if you build one, say, in, you know, in Toulouse in France, you know, where the satellite comes over, you get like one transmission a week. I mean, okay, you can still get useful information from it, but it's not, you know, it's nowhere near being a useful power source.
You got you have another caller on hold. Do you want to take it?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program tonight. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is John of Fort Worth.
Hi, John. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. One issue I kind of have with the idea of space solar, at least at this stage in human cultural development worldwide, is kind of the national security aspect of it. As if we're relying on satellites in space for power, I think that if we're having our electric power vulnerable to attack in a very clear-cut way without, you know, like dropping bombs on the country, and I kind of think that could be a very dangerous situation, given the way the world is. I mean, if we had world peace as the beauty contest is always wished for, that'd be a whole different situation.
Yeah, a great point, and I agree. There's one of the senior guys who started the solar power satellite work in Japan here. He told me, he said, you know, we have to face the fact that it's only really feasible in a peaceful scenario. But apart from this, as you say, the satellites, they're going to be big, flimsy things like butterflies that you can't possibly maneuver, so that they're very easy to attack. There's a sort of advantage that if you're going to try and attack them with a missile from the ground, you can easily see it coming. It's going to take a few hours to get up to the geostationary orbit, and you'll be able to see where it's launched with modern, you know, surveillance and so on. I don't think a surprise attack is really likely. Obviously, with a laser beam, you can hit it quicker. But again, I don't think weaponry lasers are yet powerful enough to do damage at 22,000 miles range, are they? I think they do very serious damage at a few kilometers. But I don't really want to have to agree that we have to have world peace before we can even think of building them. You wouldn't want to be majorly dependent on, you know, it wouldn't be your major power source in a situation where there's still, you know, threats of war and so on. But we're not going to be near that for a long time. I mean, we need hundreds and hundreds of gigawatts in Europe alone, and preferably thousands around the world. So even the first few tens of gigawatts, or even maybe 100 or so, I don't think the security issue is likely to be a major problem, is it? I mean, as you say, actually attacking someone's land space is somewhat different from attacking a satellite. But, right, you know, nuclear power stations are terribly vulnerable to war, aren't they? I mean, if somebody made a serious explosion of a nuclear power station, then that would be, it'd be worse than Fukushima.
No, that's true. I mean, I just think that, well, I just seem to say that they're, well, I mean, that would involve a direct attack, though, on the country. I mean, depending on which country we're talking about, of course. But, I mean, I think eventually, I guess this will be, I mean, there's nothing wrong with going ahead and developing the technology and prototyping it and testing it out, I guess, and see how it works. That's I'm not saying that. I'm just a thought that occurred to me if that becomes a major source of energy.
Yeah.
And then, you know, this a thought. Yeah. I don't know. Other than
the
that,
other one. Is that, you know, if you were majorly, if the world, you know, like the whole geostationary orbit was full of, you know, thousands of gigawatts, and it was the major source of energy, you'd be very vulnerable to attack by aliens. Just, I mean,
well, I didn't want to bring that up, but
the aliens, if they ever arrive, they're going to be so far advanced that there's nothing we can do to stop them one way or the other, I don't think.
Patrick, now that you have brought up the subject, and John, what you probably don't know is that Patrick is a kindred spirit on this subject. But, Patrick, have you paid attention to these, whatever they are, that appeared in the Navy videos that have been released? These drones or unidentified, whatever they are, that have unbelievable aerodynamic movement speeds. There were government conferences on them recently that were a letdown to most of us who were hoping for real information. Have you followed, this information over the last couple of years and your thoughts on it?
Well, I've sort of vaguely, followed that there are some reports being released that have not been released for a long time and so on. But as you say, I've been sort of a bit let down. I mean, unidentified flying object, that's what they are, isn't it? We simply don't, no one can explain what they are. I don't know. My sort of feeling about a lot of these things is if there was some alien visit ever to the Earth and they left an artifact, it could be anything, like a chewing gum wrapper or something, we would know immediately that this was not made on the Earth. I mean, with modern, analytical methods. And I've still seen no evidence, no proven thing, like a photograph of the surface of a piece of, some strange metal that you couldn't make on the Earth that completely proves it. So I'm still kind of on the skeptical side of any of these things. But on the other hand, I'm still, the pyramids are still fascinating. I've still seen no explanation of these little narrow tunnels in the pyramids that you can't get up except with a little robot and stuff. There's the story that this was built by aliens who visited 5,000 years ago or something and left a message for us. It's pretty interesting idea as a possibility, I think. But the usual argument I think is correct, isn't it? That if aliens did visit here, they would be so far ahead of us that we wouldn't be able to even understand their technology, probably, so that they could leave,
clues or something like that.
Yeah, messages and stuff. The story of the Kubrick film, the leaving a...
Oh, the obelisk,
The obelisk, yeah, so that when people find it, it sends a message. This could still be true. And it, the subject of SETI, you know, whether there are intelligent aliens elsewhere in the galaxy, is I really enjoy it. The Drake equation and the Greenback equation. I mean, we've made great progress in the last few years, haven't we? Finding planets. We never really knew if there were planets before, but now, yeah, like most stars seem to have planets. And they're homing in, I think, on some which probably have water, aren't they? And that's getting pretty interesting to add to the calculation of how many intelligent civilizations there might be in the galaxy. I haven't seen anything kind of in those recent reports that sort of lead to conclusions. One of the ones, I don't know if you saw it, a couple of years ago, I think now, was a report one evening by Tucker Carlson about an interview he'd had with some FAA people. He said it was it O'Hare Airport? They were at O'Hare Airport, he said. Mm-hmm. And these were FAA guys, so very experienced aviation people. And they all said there was this gigantic object hovering over the airport for several hours.
Yeah, I remember that.
You ever see that? Yeah. I mean, that's pretty interesting. I mean, okay, they could all be doing a prank, but he didn't think it was a prank.
Well, they have
it didn't lead to anything, but it was quite interesting.
Well, they have the ones over the nuclear sites at the Montana, air bases with the missiles, and same thing happened in the Soviet Union. So there's a lot of unexplained stories.
Oh, right.
You know,
right.
We just don't know. But anyway, I thought I'd ask you because I remember you had an interest in the topic. So.
Yeah, no, I think it's an interesting topic. It's one where there's not very many hard facts and quite a lot of speculation. But the Fermi paradox, you know, where are they? You know, if there are others, you know, the stars near the galactic center have been around for, you know, a long time before our star. And so they should already have, you know, spread throughout the galaxy. It's a pretty good argument. And so have they come, or if not, why not? And there's a long list of arguments about why not. So.
I think they're the ones that run our government, if you want to know the truth. So that's my thought. They got elected, and that's why we have so much problems with government. So, but
aren't you diving into the real conspiracy theory there, if you want to go that far?
So,
I'm a, as you mentioned,
what about that Zuckerberg guy? I mean, you know,
hold on, you're both talking at once. Go ahead, Patrick. What?
Yeah.
Sorry, just.
Well, let me say maybe he's one of them.
You know, international
alien.
Who? I think it says what it says.
I'm pulling your leg a little bit.
With that Renaissance and the space development, and the head of it, Adriana Ortina, wrote a book called "The Earth Isn't Thick." She's pregnant, and he's. Makes the analogy that, you know, a woman who's pregnant, if they didn't know what it was, would think she was sick. And if she doesn't have the baby, then they both die. But if she does, then she goes back to better health, and there's a new civilization. And he's saying that humans should have spread out into space about 50 years ago, once we developed rockets. And the original German rocket engineers, that was their plan, to start doing space travel after the war. But we still haven't done it yet. And during these 70 years, the population has grown. Well, it's doubled, I think, hasn't it? And the amount of energy and pollution we do has gone up by about 8 times. If we had started off much sooner, as we perfectly technically possible, reusable rockets were, you know, feasible back 50 years ago, we would be in a much better position now than we are. And I think that's a good argument. So between them, space policymakers of the world have not done a very good job, I would say.
John, do you have something else you'd like to add tonight?
Well, I think I better be careful and not do that. So I'll draw the line. It's an interesting discussion.
Thank you very much for your call, John.
Okay,
thanks for coming.
Listeners, we've still got a little time left. If you want to call and talk to Dr. Collins, the telephone number, 866-687-7223. And if you want to send in a late night last email, it is drspace@thespaceshow.com. Patrick, how are you spending your research time now that you're a retired professor? What's your priority project?
Right. Well, I'm still involved with this space tourism group here in Japan. I'm working at the moment with some people in Europe on a contract for the European Space Agency to do with this push to try and get the energy industry, to energy policymakers, to look at SPS seriously, which is, it's quite promising timing, as I said, because these countries, I mean, even just the other day, the Swiss government announced there will probably be blackouts this winter. And that's Switzerland, you know? And even just today on the news, here in Japan, the government was saying there are now going to be brownouts during the summer in some places. We're meant to be a developed country here, you know.
It sounds like California is spreading its culture worldwide.
Right. Well, Japan, as you know, they had this terrible thing in Fukushima where the whole nuclear industry was shown to be very incompetent. And so they had the 50 gigawatts of nuclear power stations, which were all turned off, obviously. And they did set up a very much stricter regime to get them to be allowed to turn back on again. And I think so far, this is what, 10 years later, 11 years later, only two have been allowed to restart. And because they've basically lost the total trust of the Japanese people, having said it's safe, and shown that they were, the level of complacency at the top of the nuclear industry was absolutely shocking. I mean, just literally, it's perfectly safe, you know, whatever. And the guys at the top, the real guys at the top, were just yes men. You know, they just were really shockingly incompetent people. So that they've got 48 gigawatts of nuclear power that they still can't use. Well, obviously, quite a lot of them are old now. They'll never turn them on again. The modern ones, to tell the truth, the modern nuclear reactors are totally different from the ones designed, you know, like 60 years ago,
correct,
the ones
yeah.
that blew up. There's just, the technology has moved forward in so many ways. Even the concrete is totally different, and the steel and the software and the... they even have these things called core catchers, other than most modern ones, which is a great big sheet of concrete, meters thick, underneath the whole thing to allow for the fact that the core may melt and it won't go down into the groundwater, which is what, of course, happened at Fukushima. So that I think they should be allowed to turn on the more recent ones. But question of once you've lost, it's famous, you know, it takes a long time to develop confidence, but once you lose people's confidence, it takes a long, long time to get it back. And so, lack of electricity. So that I'm sure that if Europe starts to make serious, you know, gets a budget to move forward on SPS, and I'm sure America will, and China is anyway. They've said they're interested in that as well, and they've got lots of desert where they could put the receivers. So I'm sure Japan will join in with whoever's going ahead.
You have
I'm not close enough to the space policy makers to know if they're thinking about it seriously or not. I simply don't know.
You have another call. This will probably be the last one for the evening. Hi, caller. Who are you and where are you? And thank you for calling.
Tim from Huntsville.
Hi, Tim. The end of the show always. Welcome back. Go for it.
Yeah, I was just wanting to know, these the solar panels, how much do they, what's their specific weight? Like, how much they weigh per square meter?
Thanks a lot. That's a good question, but I don't have a single figure, I'm afraid. The solar panels used on satellites and the space station and so on are designed to be as efficient as possible. So then, and light, but they're not particularly light. The solar panels designed for solar power satellites, and there's several different approaches, are very, very light. I mean, there's something like a layer of paper. You probably know that solar panels you put on your roof, the actual active photovoltaic layer is very thin. It's thinner than a millimeter. And you have to have that great big box and cover glass and so on to protect it from the weather. So the sort of the most modern designs for solar power satellites are, they're almost like a tent, you know, just a huge, great piece, floppy surface of just this unsupported, it's supported around the edges, thin panel. So they're very, very light. And I've seen, you know, different companies proposing different figures, but a figure that's often quoted now is about 1,000 tons for a gigawatt, which is 1,000 tons for several square kilometers. Well, that's very, very light compared to
panels you put on your roof or even on the satellites today. And then there's a question of, you know, will this really work? Will they be robust enough? Interestingly, very thin solar cells are more resistant to radiation in space than thicker ones, because the damage is done by solar radiating particles passing through the sort of crystal layer. And so the thinner the layer, the less likely the radiating particles are to hit anything. Whereas when you've got a fat layer, like in silicon cells, then it's more likely to damage, you know, hit the atoms and displace them in the crystal structure and thereby reduce the efficiency. So very, very light, sort of floppy solar panels may be the way to go. The only thing is then there's another approach which is popular now, which is to make what they call a sandwich, where you have a solar panel on one side and the antenna on the other. So you avoid having to have cables going from the solar panels to the antenna. So that then becomes a more rigid, heavy object. But again, there's quite a lot of work on that. There's work at the University of Southern California, I think it is, where a donor gave them $100 million to work on this, and they've got some quite good light solar panels, solar sandwich panels, in production, apparently, or, you know, that they've developed. So I'm afraid I don't have a specific figure, but there's obviously a lot of interest in making them as light as possible. But you have to have the problem of the cabling, so it's kind of swinging around, I think.
That estimate of 1,000 tons per gigawatt, that's fine. You know, that gives me a rough idea of how many Falcon 9 or Starship launches it would take to put in orbit. Now, I have another question.
I still need hundreds of launches to make a significant source of power. So that's where the research then leads to, okay, then you're going to build it on the moon. If you're going to build a few gigawatts, you can launch it from the Earth. But if you want, like, a few hundred gigawatts, then actually it starts to make sense to build as much of the heavy parts, which is, let's say, the solar panels, the antennas, and the structural components, on the lunar surface, and then launch from there, because gravity is much lower. But then you have to say, well, how are you going to get off the lunar surface? And you've got mass drivers, the traditional idea, or a lunar elevator. You know, the idea of a space elevator. There's plenty of people working quite seriously on a space elevator for the Earth, which is very difficult. But a lunar space elevator is actually much easier because the lunar gravity is so much lighter. So even existing materials are quite enough for a lunar elevator. But as you know, there's various logistical problems and so on. But there are people talking about, you know, doing a first lunar cable, you know, the elevator cable. It's got to be like, you know, I've forgotten, 60,000 kilometers long or something. But if you could do that, then you get very low-cost launch from the lunar surface. So that I tend to think that if people are serious about solar power satellites, that will be the trigger that will then lead to lunar manufacturing as well. And once you start doing stuff on the moon, all sorts of opportunities arise. So you're right. The mass is very important, and reducing launch costs is very key.
Tim, anything else? Or?
Yeah, I just posted a link in the the archive where you keep the archive at on the comment section. I posted a link talking about thermal photovoltaic cells. They developed one that actually has a 40% efficiency at 2400 degrees Celsius. Have you ever heard of that?
Right. Well, actually, this recent work done in Britain, there's a design called Cassiopeia. If you look it up, Cassiopeia Solar Power Satellite, you'll soon find it on the web because there's quite a lot of work about it. And they use gallium arsenide cells with high concentration and very high temperature of the cells. But then the cells can be much smaller. You don't need as big an area of the cells. So that that is a, as you say, it's, I would say it's quite a promising approach. I'm not an engineer, so I'm not close to the detailed design, because that sort of stuff, as you know, it's the details are very, very important. But this Cassiopeia design is the one with this the lowest mass anyone has quoted so far. And a lot of people say, it's too low, it's too low. It's not, and one of the comments is that with that hot area, you know, in space, getting rid of heat is a problem, and you need big radiators. So they may need big, heavy radiators to cool down the cells, which would offset the fact that the design is very light because of the solar cells of high concentration. So there's lots of potential for new designs still for the solar power satellites.
Well, if you have a system that runs at high temperatures, it could be mostly a reflective surface that concentrates solar energy onto the cell. So it's almost entirely just aluminized mylar, basically.
That's right. I think that's what they do in this Cassiopeia design. So the aluminium, the reflecting surface is lighter and cheaper, much cheaper than solar cells. Yeah.
Tim, anything else?
Still some quite interesting combinations of reflectors, and even other designs. You know that you do a basic design, but if you build some reflectors nearby, you know, and you can take the heat, if you can, you know, use that, then it's certainly a very cheap way of increasing the power. Yeah.
Tim, we're over time, so do you have anything else?
Well, that's it.
Thank you for your call.
Thanks.
Patrick, any concluding comments, any words of wisdom, anything you'd like to say as we get ready to sign off?
Right. I'm not sure about words of wisdom, but I think that there's really good potential just now. And as always, I'm interested in this whole field for as much as anything, for the fact that the Western world is really at the moment lacking in new industries, and particularly with this huge push towards robotics and AI and so on. They say there's going to be a whole lot of jobs are going to disappear. I mean, they even talk about automated trucks, so that several million truckers will get unemployed and so on. And with all this stuff and 3D printing and so on, there's so much potential that building lunar hotels and sports stadiums so we can have the Lunar Olympics is much easier than it would have been like 20 years ago or 30 years ago, and could create employment on really almost any scale we want to, so that for solving the economic problems of unemployment and so on. I think this space renaissance, this push, once it gets underway with fully reusable low-cost launch vehicles and so on, will be terrific and be as interesting and expanding as the renaissance was back, whatever it was, 500 years ago in Europe.
Well, listen, if you come to Las Vegas to win the money for your research contracts, let me know. So I'd love to see you. And we'll have to check in with you later to see how things are going and some of these projects on solar are going. It's a big, interesting topic for the space show, and it's unfortunate that it's still just a discussion topic. And I've been doing the show for 21 years, but when did you write your doctoral dissertation on space solar power satellites?
Space solar power satellites, I think it was finished in 86.
So oh, my God.
40 years.
I'm just a youngster.
35 years.
Yeah, I'm just a youngster at 21 years, so that I've been talking about this. So, and I remember you're talking about Space 2000 and going over to Japan for that, and it didn't materialize, did it?
Not yet. The thing that sort of encourages me is that the working on the solar power satellite idea, became very clear that it all depends on the launch cost.
Uh-huh.
So that was correct. And then to get the launch costs down, you've got to have a big market. And so that's why the idea I got interested in space tourism. And several other people I met, for example, Tom Rogers in America and this
right.
Nagatomo in Japan and so on, had come to the same conclusion, that to make a big market, that tourism is perfectly sensible, isn't it? Or, it could be like air travel and so on. And that we're moving in that direction. And it's happening, slowly. But as I was just saying just now about, we'll need a low orbit demonstrator of some sort for SPS, before, I think, before investors, whether they're government or private, cough up billions for a geostationary satellite. And so I still think a satellite designed to go around the equator would be an interesting way of doing that. I haven't seen what I consider a better idea. But, so I kind of foresee continuing progress in these directions with potential at any time for real jump forward. You know, if the Starship works first time, and there is, you know, more or less according to plan, that's going to encourage a lot of people to book flights. And they'll soon have a mass production line pumping out Starships, which can only be a good thing, I would have thought.
I hope so. Patrick, I want to thank you for coming back on the space show, and for sure we'll stay in touch, and we'll check in with you down the road, and maybe we'll see some progress someplace on space solar power in a real demo that is needed. It'd be nice if the media kind of got behind it like they do on climate change, you know, but I guess it doesn't.
Well, that's the point. Yeah, it's potentially a key answer to their concerns about climate change. So So it's quite a promising situation,
well,
I think.
Europe,
anyway. Yeah.
Space solar power needs its Greta to go out there and snow the world. So.
good way to put it.
Yeah, let's just leave it at that. Patrick,
yeah.
Thank you, and have a great rest of the morning and a great rest of the day where you are, and we'll shut it down for the night on the Pacific Coast, and we'll talk to you soon. I'll send you the archives when I get it done in the morning, and it's been great catching up with you and talking to you again, and
yeah.
I look forward to the
great
next time. Thanks, Patrick.
And for the guests as well.
Listeners, thank you for your calls, for your emails. And everybody have a great week. The week is young, and enjoy it. Stay safe, stay healthy, and as always, keep looking up. Good night from Patrick, David, and the Space Show.